Today is Thursday, November 26, 2020. This is a part 6 Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Pat Gredigan, spelled G-R-E-D-I-A-G-I-N. My name is Tom Martin. And good afternoon, Pat. How are you?
I'm full from Thanksgiving dinner, but otherwise just great. Thank you.
Good. Glad to hear it. Pat, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you have my permission.
Thank you. At the end of part 5, you had started to take us on a year's journey around the world and had spent some time telling us about a trek in the Himalayas out and looping back to Kathmandu in late fall of 1989. And then what happened?
My trip around the world was only 10 months long, and I had I was off of work for a year, as it turns out, and the first month I was getting ready and stashing stuff, and the last month I was back and looking for jobs, so the travel time itself was about 10 months. I always just called it a year because it was close enough, but for this, I'll clarify that it was 10 months, and so what happened next was I had the whole idea was that I wanted to get to some places while I was still on the younger side of things than after I waited and retired and was, quote, older, which, of course, now I'm older and doesn't feel like I'm really old. But so I wanted to travel when I was still young, which is why I decided to quit and do this traveling with the idea that I probably could get back into the Park Service. And I had mapped out in my mind some places that I wanted to see. And so the Nepal trip had been kind of an add-on at the beginning because I had encountered Ginger Harmon on this work trip in the Grand Canyon and had been in touch enough, I guess, to join in with the trip that she was organizing. So I had thrown that in at the front of my travels, but then I picked up on what my original itinerary was, which was to start in New Zealand and work my way basically westward from there. And so I flew from Nepal to, well, I think technically I went to Thailand and then got a flight from there to New Zealand. My sister, I have two sisters. One, I'm the oldest, Sue is the next, and Anne is the youngest of the three of us. I have no brothers. And Sue is the one that had gone down on the Grand Canyon River trip with me in 1988. Anne decided she'd like to join me in New Zealand. So I got there, we joined up in Churchill on the South Island. And we traveled together on the South Island about 2 weeks. We rented a car and drove around, and it was December, and I remember we hiked, we did a couple of backpacks there. Now, of course, I can't remember the main one that is on the south end of the island there, but it classically has clouds and fogs and rain because it's a wet environment, sort of like the Pacific Northwest, which it reminded me of a bit, but we had great weather on this hike, which maybe I'll remember by the end of the interview what the name of it was. And so we just went camping and hiking and toured the island and enjoyed seeing it. And then she flew out, and within a few days, my friend Mary Lynn Friley, Mary Lynn is M-A-R-I-L-Y-N-N.
Okay.
And Friley, F-R-I-L-E-Y, joined me, and by then I had gone up to the North Island. So we spent, I think we spent about 10 days on the North Island, just touring around again with a rental or buses or whatever. And then we went to the South Island, and there was a park named Abel Tasman. We decided we were going to hike in there, and it happened to be over Christmas, and we hiked up into this area where there's, so I think we were hiking from a hut or a kind of a big hut, hut-to-hut sort of thing.
Okay.
And we got to the first one, and it snowed on us.
Oh, wow.
And there was this whiteout, and so we ended up turning around the next morning and going out because we felt like we might not be able to follow the trail very well. And there was probably only a couple inches of snow on the ground at the hut, and it decreased as we went out. But I was, I recollect recognizing the fact that even though I was in the Southern Hemisphere, I was having a white Christmas, and it just didn't seem like, well, it seemed right for a northerner, but it didn't seem like what I expected I'd be encountering in the Southern Hemisphere. So that was of interest to me.
What, do you think it was because you were basically so far south?
I don't know. It would have been like there June, I guess, and I guess it's just,
yeah but latitude-wise, you know,
right.
you're getting kind of closer to the South Pole, so maybe,
right.
You know, does it snow in June in Alaska?
I don't know.
I bet it does.
Yeah.
On occasion.
And at a certain elevation. Right?
Yeah, yeah, or at least more than it might in Flagstaff or someplace.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like that.
Yeah. I don't think that this was the weather event of the century at all. But
okay.
It was a surprise to me.
Yeah, I bet.
To be snowed on.
Huh.
So that was another 2 weeks there, so about a month in New Zealand. And then Mary Lynn joined me flying to Australia, and we camped. I think we just went by public transport out of Sydney into the Blue Mountains and then on to the coast a little bit, and she stuck around for another week or so, and then she flew home, and I continued to just explore without a car. Eventually I took the train across the Nullarbor Desert in the southern part of Australia to
wow.
the west coast of Australia to Perth, and stayed in hostels and just kind of poked around a lot. When I was there, so I was in Australia for all of 2 months, I think 2 months. I was on the west coast, and this young Canadian woman who had bought a car and was traveling around was looking for people to go back towards the east with her and share with gas expenses and
oh.
stuff. So I volunteered, and some fellow from Germany or something, I don't know what, volunteered, and the three of us drove back to Melbourne into the southeast part of Australia. I remember she was a really interesting woman because she was probably in her 20s, and she was a veterinarian, and she also knew how to fly helicopters. And I was
wow.
like, wow. So, but I never kept up with her or anything like that. And so I think I spent, like I said, a total of 2 months in Australia. From there, I went to, I think about this, Kenya, because I had wanted to go and see wildlife in Africa before it, you know, diminished and disappeared.
Yeah. Wow.
So I went to Kenya for, I think I was in Africa for all of 2 months total. So that was mostly Kenya and then a little bit in Tanzania. And again, I just stayed in hostels or YMCAs or a cheap motel, and traveled by public transport, which was mostly buses,
mm-hmm.
and went to different, you couldn't go, or if you went into parks, most of the parks you had to have be on a safari, and you couldn't just walk around and hike there as you do in our parks, because you would probably get eaten by a lion or something,
right.
You know, along those lines. So the access to the wild parks and wildlife was not as readily available just to rent a car and drive into it. So I ended up getting a safari. And there was a German fellow that was on the safari. It's interesting, when you travel, you sort of bump up against people and exchange addresses. And later, when I was in Germany, I went and visited him.
Oh, cool.
So it was just this random mix of people that are traveling around. And so I went on a safari. I think I went on a couple of them. I went on one in Kenya and then into Tanzania. And I took a bus in Kenya or Tanzania, one of them, to Olduvai Gorge, I think it's called, some of the first footprints of Homo sapiens, I think, were
and
found.
First bone fragments, et cetera. Louis Leakey.
Yes, and I think his wife actually is the one that found these footprints down there. But
cool.
So I was interested in that and wildlife. And the last month, maybe the last 10 days that I was in Africa, which was in Tanzania, another friend, actually a Park Service fellow, and I wish I could remember his last name, Brad. Right now, I knew him pretty well at the time, but his last name slips my mind right now. He joined me, and we traveled around Tanzania together a little bit and went out to Zanzibar Island on some little sort of cheap putt-putt boat, and then ended up probably back in Nairobi, or I don't remember where we flew out of, but went to Egypt for a little bit. And the idea was to go down the Nile and to Luxor.
Wow.
And see that little section, because we'd only allocated maybe 7 days or 10 days for there. But he ended up coming down with either typhoid fever or typhus. I think they're slightly different things.
Oh, wow.
But it was one of those. And he got pretty ill and went to a doctor there and basically just had to stay around Cairo. And so I just stuck around Cairo as well and went off and did some touring of the pyramids and stuff on my own. But he was not really in good shape to do much tourist stuff while we were there. Then he flew home, and I went next to, I guess I went next to Greece, traveled around Greece a little bit, then got a boat, like maybe a couple weeks in Greece, then I got a boat or took a ferry up to Yugoslavia, which was still Yugoslavia at the time. I remember I could not go overland through Albania because Albania wouldn't let people into their borders much at all.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And so I went to Yugoslavia, and it was just starting to break up. But I went to where my grandmother was born in what is now Serbia.
Oh, wow.
It was a little village called Mrkopalj, really small little village. But I got a bus, went there, and there was no kind of place to stay or anything like that. So I got off the bus with my backpack because I knew there was a bus out of town like 2 hours later.
Okay.
And I went into some building or facility or a store, I think, and sort of mimed, can I leave my pack there? Because I didn't want to carry my pack all around town with me. And then I just walked around this little village and went into a cemetery to see if I could recognize any names that I might have heard from my grandma, but I didn't. And then pretty soon, and it was, I didn't see people at all. It was, I think, a Sunday. Maybe people were home, so I didn't really have any interaction with people. It was just kind of a vacant, small little village. And then I got back on the bus and left.
What was its name again, the village? How do you spell it?
Mrkopalj. Mrkopalj, I think.
Okay.
And that's it. What is... I might have said Serbia, but it was in Croatia.
Croatia, okay.
It was in Croatia. And from there, I went into... there's a northern part of Yugoslavia that has a capital named Ljubljana, which I love to say. And it's not Czechoslovakia, Slovenia. Slovenia. It might have been Slovenia. Now I can't remember what the country name is. But it was real pretty. It was kind of a, felt like I was in Austria, and indeed I was near Austria, or next, I think it shares a border with Austria. And so I went into Austria, which is where I think my Eurorail, my 3-month Eurorail pass was valid. And so I had a 3-month URL, and I started it in Austria.
Okay.
And then I traveled through Western Europe, Italy, and I didn't spend much time in France, some time in Spain and Portugal, and then kind of went north through Belgium and into the, into Scandinavia. I went to Sweden and way up north and back down through, in Finland and down through Norway. And then I guess I ended up in Paris. I think I ended up in Paris, and this is 3 months later.
Wow.
That trip was mostly going from urban center to urban center because that's where the trains and the transportation took me.
Right.
And I had decided to do a self-study. I never had much of an art background, but there was a great Rick Steves, who's the travel author book called, I think, Art 101 or European Art History 101.
Oh, wow.
And I had taken that with me, and he would talk about the evolution of art through the last 1,000 or 2,000 ages and 2,000 years. And I would go to different museums and kind of reference his book and look and see what I was seeing. And that was really fun. I did come away with a much greater understanding of art and the classics.
Cool.
Then I went to England for just 4 or 5 days. It was real short because by then I had decided I was really kind of looking forward to going home. And I flew back to Oregon, which is where I had, my family was based. And I think I had, I think I had stashed my stuff there in Oregon. So I went back there and.
So Pat?
Yes?
Looking back today.
Yeah.
At that 10-month journey, was there anything that really hit you or impressed you that you still carry with you today?
Well, one of the things, I didn't set out with the idea of coming away with this feeling, but when I was done, I did feel like I had felt very comfortable the whole, you know, as far as I remember, the whole time traveling as a solo with, you know, specific things a solo female with specific things that I wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a sort of a sense of accomplishment. I would, in retrospect, I would say that that's probably something I came away with, that it wasn't that hard. You know, you can scare yourself like, I don't speak the language, or I don't, you know, I feel vulnerable or something like that. But I had just sort of set my intentions. I wanted to go see stuff. I went and did it. It worked out beautifully. And I felt a sense of satisfaction that I had gone out and seen this bigger world that, and not just waited or put it off or never done it. So
yeah.
I that was a feeling I had.
Cool.
As far as any specific, I do remember feeling really good about my understanding of art that I came away with,
mm-hmm.
with the Europe part.
Yep.
And that I had seen that wildlife in Africa, had gone on and seen some of the wildlife. Mostly I just get curious about places. I just have a curiosity about what they look like, and it's really more landscape-based than cultural. And so I satisfy that curiosity when I travel.
Cool.
And that was kind of what I did, was I satisfy the curiosity. And then I was ready to be back here for a while and kind of resume life that the trajectory was on here with the Park Service.
Very cool. I just can't imagine one could travel for 10 months around the world and not come back transformed a little bit.
Right. I'm sure I was. You know, I'm not sure I can express what the difference was, but I was definitely a different person for having been exposed to all I had been exposed to and the course of traveling versus if I had never done that.
Right.
It just broadens you.
Yeah.
Broadens a person.
Cool. So back to the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. So my idea had been that I would apply for permanent jobs that would come up that were GS7 or better, because by now I was a GS7, so that was my standard, and I wanted to get a GS7 or better job. And so I would watch the announcements would come out, I think, once a week with what jobs were open in the Park Service that were permanent jobs.
Was that like in the newspaper, or how did you find those?
Well, it was called a pink sheet, and I don't know how I found those. Maybe, in fact, I'm not sure exactly where I was for that period of time.
Is that something you would see in a personnel office in a park somewhere?
Yes, you would, right. And so, well, one of the things was that I hadn't started applying for the permanent job yet, because I applied for some seasonal jobs just as a fill-in.
Okay.
And I was offered a seasonal position at Death Valley during the winter. I think it started in October or something. They were hiring people to work at Scotty's Castle and give tours. And because I had permanent status, they could just offer me a job without going through the rating and ranking of all the candidates that applied that didn't have status. And so they offered me a job because I apparently was good enough to hire as a permanent employee somewhere, so they figured I must, you know, have I must have some kind of ability to do a job.
And was that a GS7 position?
No, that one wasn't. So
okay.
as a seasonal, I was having to just take whatever I got offered. It probably was a GS5. It's what I think. It's probably a 5 again.
Okay.
It could have been I think it was a 5.
I was going to say it could have been a 3 or something. I mean,
yeah, it could have been a 4, but I think it might have been a 5.
Okay.
One of those two, probably. What they had started doing just the year before or that year at Scotty's Castle was to do a living history program, so that instead of a park ranger giving you a tour through this building that was built by a rich man and his wife, the Johnsons, who came to the desert and built this big mansion, and they stumbled across this guy, Scotty, that was a character and had sort of been a miner. I don't know if he really had much in the way of a mine, but he was a miner basically. But he palled up with the Johnsons, and they liked him, and he liked hanging out with them. And pretty soon, because of his oversized character, he became the person that people associated with this building.
Right.
And it became known as Scotty's Castle because he was just a big, colorful guy, colorful character. So instead of park rangers giving the tour through there, they wanted us to dress in period as if we were somebody that would have, like they had stepped back in time. Like
oh, interesting. Okay.
Right. So there were some volunteers in the park that would sew costumes from old patterns from that period. And my character was the housekeeper. So I had kind of a 1930s is when we were supposed to be set. So I had a 1930s sort of style dress, and you wouldn't wear your normal wristwatch on your wrist. You would probably hide it in your pocket or something like
right.
that. But we tried as much as possible to look like they were back in the 1930s. And so I gave tours, and my college education had been in how to be a park naturalist, basically, or a park interpreter is the formal name of the option I had gotten a degree in, and that was how to give tours to people. I leaned towards the idea of giving tours of nature, but here I was giving tours of building, and I really enjoyed just doing that for a change, because I'd never really put that giving a tour to use, and the idea of provoking people's thought processes to be curious about this or that. And
wow, that's really it's really neat, because it's something very different than law enforcement, where you're provoking people to show you their driver's license.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh.
And so again, I was back into that level of so I would go home at night. I wouldn't have to worry about a call out or anything like that. And there was a bunch of seasonals that were, I lived down at Furnace Creek, actually, because they didn't have enough housing for everyone. And then a van would haul us up to Scotty's Castle each day, and then we'd go back down to Furnace Creek. And so there was a volleyball net there, and every 2 days a week there'd be volleyball games. And
cool.
It was fun. There's a swimming pool there that they have, really it's called their fire water reservoir. So if there was a fire in the park, there's a reservoir water, but it's really a swimming pool. I mean, it's dual function.
Yeah.
But, of course, it was cold in the winter month, but by March it was warm enough to go swimming and enjoy it. So I had a grand time exploring. I didn't have a truck, so my exploring of the park was limited to whoever I could, that might have a truck that I could talk into going out and poking around somewhere on some of the dirt roads or just tooling around.
Did you still have your VW?
Well, let me think. What did I have there? No, I don't think I had the VW anymore. I think I might have had a little Toyota for a while. I probably had that Toyota Corolla wagon. Yeah. So I enjoyed being in the park and kind of having that climate through the winter and poking around into the park as much as I could on my days off. It was fun and doing this interpretive job. So I did that for about 6 months. And then I'm sure at that point I would have been watching for those vacancy announcements to see what permanent jobs were open.
Did you think about, sorry, I'm just going to jump in. Did you think about tracking down the chief ranger and introducing yourself and saying, hi, I'm here, and this is my story, and just want you to know? Was Death Valley a place that you were like, well, I want to do this for a couple months, and I don't want this to be my next park?
I don't think that that was a good idea. I think I would have taken a job at Death Valley if there had been an opening. I don't think there was an opening.
Okay.
But now that you mentioned that, I do remember that I went to their law enforcement refresher.
Oh.
I talked my way with my boss. So every year you have to have 40-hour refresher. And I thought, well, I'm pretty sure I went through their refresher because I thought, well, maybe I'll get a job in 3 weeks somewhere and I will have needed to have had this refresher in the last period of a year,
right,
which I wouldn't have had if I didn't get it at Death Valley.
Hmm.
And usually parks offer those refreshers once a year when they're bringing all their seasonals on. So if I got a job in Timbuktu or Tuzigut in December, I might not have been able to get a refresher course very soon. So I think I took a refresher course at Death Valley. So the chief ranger there, who I can't remember who that was at this point, would have known who I was. I don't think there was any jobs open, so it never became a point of
an issue.
Let's maybe hire her.
Mm-hmm.
But I watched the vacancy announcements, and I don't remember any jobs that I particularly applied for, but I'm guessing I applied for a job or two. I wouldn't have been too picky. I wanted to stay in the West. It would have been law enforcement, or backcountry was really my preference, or river. So I don't remember what I may have applied for during that period, but I know I would have been watching.
Okay.
And I did not get any kind of job during that period. And so I had applied to work in Denali in Alaska for their summer season as a seasonal. And again, they could hire me without me having to go through the normal course of applying as a seasonal. And my logic for that was I wanted to see Alaska on the government dime, basically, without being committed to being up there for a long time.
Yeah.
If I got a permanent job. So I did get a job there, and I went to Alaska in the spring of, that would have been 90, right?
Yeah.
Spring. Well, you know what? I'm a year behind because it was 91.
That's right. Your year of travel was 1990. So now we're in 1991.
90, right. And then the winter of 90-91, it was at Death Valley. In the spring of 91, I think it was May, because Death Valley didn't start their season. They had short seasons because things didn't thaw out.
Okay.
Until later. So I went to I went up to Alaska, and I think I rode the ferry up there.
Okay.
I know I was on the ferry a time or two, but my sister,
like the inland
Anne, had,
Inland Passage.
Yes.
Uh huh.
My sister Anne had ended up working in the Army. She was an officer in the Army, and she had been assigned to Fort Wainwright, which is outside of Fairbanks. And I had traveled up there with her, I think, in 1986 or so, and just spent a week up there with her when she was first going there. And we were on a ferry a little bit, but I think that I also took the ferry on my own up to Alaska with my car, I guess. I don't remember driving up. I remember driving out. So,
hey, Pat. Before
yeah.
we go to Alaska,
yeah.
what can you tell? What was the coolest thing you saw at Scotty's Castle?
Well, what's the coolest thing I saw? Well, maybe only because it was a rarity. There's an organ there that was part of the original furnishings that I think is seldom played, but was played, and it plays by itself, like
okay.
it has a, like those old pianos used to have where you put in a scroll and
right.
played from that, and I think that they played it once or twice when I was there, and
wow.
I can't remember if they had someone tune it up or why it got played, but I know that that wasn't very common to play that, and it was played, so I think I'd have to say that probably was pretty cool.
Cool.
And also, they had Tiffany lamps. I started becoming aware of what a Tiffany product was, and they had some Tiffany lamps in there, and I was like, cool, this is Tiffany stuff, wow. And then I liked all the iron handiwork that they had, like hinges. The craftsmanship was cool. I really enjoyed the craftsmanship
yeah.
of that.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll tell you a side story, though, real quick, about Scotty's Castle.
Yeah.
The coolest thing I had at Scotty's Castle was actually in 1979 when Tom Cox and I had gone to Santa Rosa to get our law enforcement training, and we met a fellow there in that class that was working at Scotty's Castle. So when Tom and I were driving back from Scotty's Castle, from Santa Rosa to Utah, we decided to stop in Scotty's Castle, and I think the guy's name was Dan Brown, something like that. They let people sleep in the clock tower there.
Oh, wow.
So instead of camping out, he said, well, you know, we just use this as kind of a guest quarters when people come through. And so we got to sleep in the bottom of the clock tower. There's a little apartment.
Oh, my gosh.
Small. I don't think it was very big at all. But so that was kind of cool to be able to sleep in the clock tower. But I didn't do that when I worked there in 1991.
Hmm.
And I think the handcrafted items and the organ probably were the coolest things that
cool.
I enjoyed.
Fun. All right, thank you.
Yeah.
So at Alaska, your sister's there. Did she come out to greet you, or did you come up the Inland Passage with her?
Well, so she was up assigned there before, like a few years before, and I think she must have been gone because when I was up there in 1991, I don't remember. She wasn't there anymore. She had transferred on.
Okay.
So, no, she didn't. So I went into the park in May, and I can remember just there being such tall. Everything was green and growing about half a foot a day. It just burst out and grew fast because it had to grow fast because it was going to be, you know, cold and practically heading on winter by early September.
Yeah.
So I remember being impressed with that. It was kind of moist, kind of a little bit rainy in May, and mosquitoes. But the mosquitoes were kind of here and not there, or not there and here. And so it was kind of patchy, and I don't remember being plagued every moment of every day by mosquitoes.
Oh, good.
If you got in certain spots, you would be like, oh, this is not the spot I want to hang out.
Hmm.
So I did road patrol there on the east end of the park. So there's the road that goes So the East End is where there's, gosh, I forgot the name of the town outside, but it's near the little town. It's the entrance town, and the headquarters is there, and the visitor center is there, and most people live there. Then there's a road that goes to the west, and is they use buses to take people. People can't drive it unless they've got some special permit for something. It's really special. But you take your take a bus out if you're a visitor and go out towards Eielson Visitor Center, which is out in the interior of the park, or Wonder Lake, which is at the end. But I was working on that east end where most of the people and the offices and they had a sled team there, a dog sled team.
Oh, wow.
And so the dog sled team was kept there, the kennels were there. And I did road patrol and was restricted to that east end where the campground was and everything else. And once again, the main thing I could remember is that I had some night patrols, and I'm like, oh, well, this is going to be terrible because I'm not really a night person. But it was light until like 12:30, and then it was kind of gray, and then it was light again at 3. You know, it was just light
so
long that my body responded to it being light, and I stayed awake more readily because of the light. It's when it gets dark early that I just kind of go, oh, I can't, you know, my body goes to sleep when it gets dark. But so I had some late patrols, and I did not get to see the Aurora Borealis.
Uh-oh.
To this day, I've never seen them. So either they weren't firing, or I think they weren't firing, but it's light so late that it's hard to see them.
Right.
If they were, because of the lightness. So I was there for just a couple months. I don't remember, because the next job came up, which I'll tell you about. I'm trying to though remember if there's anything. I made a couple friends that are still friends there during that summer. Jim Unruh was the pilot in the, no, he was head of dispatch there, but he later became a pilot in a park I worked at in Big Bend.
How do you spell his last name?
U-N-R-U-H, Unruh.
Thank you.
And Darla Seidels was working dispatch for Jim. And her last name is S-I-D-L-E-S.
Thank you.
And she then shows up in Big Bend, where I went to next.
Oh.
And was trail crew there. So all three of us show up in Big Bend again. Or are in Big Bend down the road, you know, another few months.
Cool.
And they both became people that I consider, you know, lifetime friends, but I actually haven't been in touch for a while, but you know how that goes.
Yeah.
Darla is now the superintendent at Rocky Mountain.
Wow.
She did really well. Jim's retired. But I don't remember much other than driving around and telling people that they couldn't camp where they were, you know, pulled over to the campground before, and they'd think about sleeping in a parking lot in the park, and I'd have to kick them out, and I don't know where they went to. Maybe there was some other place where they could camp.
Hmm.
But I don't have any vivid memories of any particular oh, yes, I do. A guy was missing, one of the concessions employees, out in the park. He'd gone out for like a backpack or something like that. And he wasn't found, and so you usually send a hasty team out to try and check the spot where they were last known, and he wasn't located, so it geared up, and we ended up doing a grid search, which is super labor intensive and usually kind of a last resort because it just takes so many people.
Hmm.
But you spread out 6 feet apart, 10 feet apart, 20 feet apart, depends upon how much vegetation there is and how easily you could see. And then you maybe were 10 or 15 feet apart, maybe in the park, I can't remember. And then you just try and walk parallel to each other and cover a swath of ground with a bunch of people. And so we did this grid search, and my group found the guy, and he was dead. I don't know if they ever determined, he had some like scratches on him, but he didn't look like he'd been mauled.
Huh.
So I'm not sure what his cause of death was. I can't remember anymore whether he was speculated that maybe he'd fallen and hurt himself, and but he had scrapes or something like that. But I remember that search and finding the guy, and you know, he was deceased. Other than that, I went with on a backpack. There was a fellow from who had been a seasonal at the Grand Canyon that was a seasonal interpreter up there that liked the backpack. So I remember we went out with another third person and did a night or two backpack, which was so different than anything I'd ever done before, because you're fording streams with your shoes on. That's when I figured out if you wore gaiters, it kept water from going down into your shoes. Tall gaiters work pretty well.
Interesting.
Keep the water from flooding into the top of your shoes.
Right.
And we had some tussocks, they call it. They're like tall clumps of grass that might be about a foot, maybe 16 inches around in a circle. But then there's a void of nothing between that and the next tussock, which is a foot to the side. And so if you either walk from tussock to tussock, and they wobble a little, or you're kind of stepping down a foot down in between the tussocks, which gets real cumbersome to try and walk through. So the tussock was a beast to try and get through. Of course, we had to take precautions for bears and keep our food preparation well away from where our tents were and all the food odors separated from where we were going to be sleeping. So that was kind of fun. It was kind of work, too. And it was maybe there was sprinkled on us or something like that, because I remember thinking, like, well, I'm glad I had this experience, but I'm not really going to be looking for lots of opportunities to go backpacking in Alaska. It's a lot of work, and it was kind of wet. And it was good to get to do it and have that experience, but I wasn't really sold on it.
And climbing Denali wasn't on your radar screen.
Yeah, it wasn't on my radar screen. At all.
Okay.
So I had my little couple months experience there, and in July I was offered one of the jobs I had applied, or you know, a job I applied for, and again I can't remember how many I applied for and didn't get, but I applied for and did get the River District Ranger job.
Ooh.
In Big Bend. So I now am in Canyonlands, I was just the ranger. And now I'm the district ranger that supervised the district operation in Big Bend. There was only like three of us on the team, so it wasn't like it was a big staff. But it was a step up, and I think I was a GS. I think I was a GS-9 there.
Wow.
So,
okay, so that's a ladder rung up.
Yeah, right, a ladder rung up. And so I was a little bit nervous about going and working on the border, and of course the river is the border, so you're not just sort of close to the border, you are patrolling the border.
Right.
When you're doing a river patrol. I think I might have mentioned, well, I can't remember if I mentioned Steve Swanky before. He was one of the district rangers in Canyonlands after I worked there. Well, Steve Swanky was a Park Service guy that worked in Arches when I first was a seasonal in Canyonlands, and I don't remember where he got a permanent job, but he ended up being the River District Ranger in Canyonlands. I'm trying to think how the timing went, but it probably was in the maybe 89, 90, something like that, or maybe a little bit after. But he had been the district ranger at Big Bend before I got there in 91. So
okay.
He was definitely in Big Bend. Maybe he went to Canyonlands from there.
Hmm.
But he had been working down there, and I knew him pretty well. We'd done river trips together, and you know, part of that gang of young people that hangs out together.
Uh-huh.
And so he's the one that had recommended me to the guy that was doing the hiring there. I guess it was the assistant chief ranger, and he had contacted me and said, Pat, you might be interested in this job. I think you'd be perfect for it. You know, it's they're looking for a river ranger. And I was like, yeah, okay. But then I was like, well, but Steve, it's right on the border. What kind of, you know, what kind of border incidents and problems and drug runners and smugglers, you know, what's going on there? I don't want to get into a a place where I have to wear body armor down the river or something like that. And he said, well, it's really not that bad. It's, you know, there were a few incidents there in the 80s. There actually was a shooting. I don't remember the particulars now, but it's been a few years before. So there had been some random, not good stuff a couple times. And he said, yeah, there's some random, not good stuff, but day to day to day, it's really not a problem or an issue. And I think you'll find that it's okay. And so I said, okay. And so I had applied and I got offered the job. And so I talked to my boss in Denali, who completely understood that even though he had hired me with the expectation that I would be there until September when the season ended, that here I was getting a good job that was a permanent job, and that, of course, I was going to accept it. And too bad for Denali that they had, you know, that I vacated that seasonal job, but he understood. And so I went on down the road in July and drove. It took me like 7 or 8 days probably to drive from Alaska to Big Bend. It might have taken me a...
Did you take the Alcan? Did you drive the Alcan down?
I did drive the Alcan.
Okay.
And I took the time to swing by Banff and Jasper for a quick visit.
Cool.
And then mostly I just kept driving down.
Yeah.
And I should say, actually, I should say that another thing I didn't mention earlier, but when I was 9 years old and my family was moving from California to Oregon, we went via Alaska because my dad's brother had moved to Alaska sometime earlier in the 60s. So in 1964, my dad and mom decided that Alaska was the land of opportunity and that we should go up there and move up there. So they had sold most of the house and gotten rid of most of the stuff and packed up some household stuff into a cargo trailer that my dad had made. And we had this truck and we drove up to Alaska on the Alcan. And my two sisters and I were in the back of the truck, bored to tears.
Oh.
and we stayed in Alaska all of about 9 days, got chewed up by mosquitoes. My dad and mom looked for work and realized that there was not a lot of openings for any kind of work. So they just went up there cold. And they decided that it didn't look good. And so we turned around and drove back down the Alcan Highway to Oregon, where my mom got a teaching job and my dad started building houses. So it wasn't my first trip on the Alcan, but it'd been many years. So there I was driving down the Alcan again 40 years later or whatever it was, 30 years later. Went to Big Bend and started my job as a River District Ranger there in 1991.
Did you get an orientation to the river and how it works? I mean, I would be kind of intimidated to be a boss over some people that are, you know, over a river of which I haven't run before and
right,
I don't know anything
right.
about. I would imagine there's a little bit of trepidation with that, and that I would be kind of calmed down if somebody said, hey, we're going to give you a 2-week tour of, you know, this and that, then here's...
Yeah. I can't remember. I remember those. I'm sure that I was like, okay, what's the lay of the land here? How does this all work?
Right.
You know, who's who? What's the river like? How bad is it? What's going on? There was a, let me make sure I got all this timing right. There was a fellow named Marcos Paredes, who was the river ranger. And he,
how do you spell his last name?
Paredes, P-A-R-A-D-E-S.
Sorry. And he was really,
his first name was Marcos. Marcos.
Right.
And he was the river ranger.
Okay.
He was the permanent that wasn't the district ranger.
Okay.
So he was, and he had, Terlingua is near Big Bend on the west side, and there are commercial river runners in Terlingua that run through the canyons in the park. And so he had worked for them for a bit and somehow got, he was Hispanic. He spoke Spanish wonderfully. He was a great liaison with people who were on the south side of the river on the border.
Yeah.
And so he was both very skilled with running that river and knowledgeable of that river. But he also kind of knew the people. He was a local, more or less, and he was, yeah. He's still there, so he's very local, long-term local.
Hmm.
So I'm sure he was the person that gave me the most information. And I don't remember my first patrol. I don't remember, you know, where it was or what it looked like, but Marcos almost certainly was on it because he would have been the guy that knew the stuff.
Had he applied for the job, the district ranger job?
He might have. I can't remember if he applied or not. He probably did, because why wouldn't you? But I don't remember that there was any kind of...
Oh, good.
If he had applied, I don't remember any kind of undercurrents of bitterness or resentment or anything like that. He was, you know, he was a good guy, and we got along. We got along pretty well. He had a different... way of, my brain's very linear, and he was kind of really about big ideas sometimes, and sometimes I'd say, Marcos, I don't think that's real realistic here, and you know, so we both, which is probably a good combo. I've always heard that when you have a people who are different than that, you get the best production out of that, because you don't have the same thought processes going on in two different heads, but
right.
But we were different kinds of thinkers, and so sometimes it was like, what? What are you talking about?
Mm.
But all in all, we got along fine. So there was a seasonal. They had a seasonal that summer that was working. Oh, I can't remember his name. But I remember doing a patrol through Santa Elena with him, so maybe he was the one that oriented me to Santa Elena. Big Bend... maybe I'll describe it real quick.
Please.
The Rio Grande River, Rio Grande, I think that's how I mostly said it, is the southern border of the U.S., and it's also the southern border of Big Bend National Park.
Hmm.
And most of the water in that stretch of the Rio Grande comes out of Mexico, because south of, downstream of El Paso, it pretty much soaks into all of the riverbed, and there's a massive amount of tamarisks that live in there and transpire off the moisture, and there's not much, there's certainly no surface water, and probably not much subterranean water that trickles down to the Rio Grande in the park area. So most of the water is released out of a dam in Mexico pursuant to some water treaty agreement, just as we deliver Colorado River water to Mexico. They deliver some water into the Rio Grande that comes from a major fork in Mexico upstream of Big Bend.
Hmm. So same watershed, just a side tributary that's got a dam on it.
Right.
Okay.
That's operated by Mexico.
Okay.
And so the water levels in Big Bend are dependent upon that water mostly, or else local rainfall. Sometimes there's monsoons there in the summer that really kick up the water, but not a lot comes out of like Colorado and down through the Rio Grande drainage into Big Bend from the U.S. So when I first got there, the water was reasonably high, but within a year, it had dropped down to where we mostly were canoeing all these runs. But, I was going to describe it first. Right on the west end of where the river enters the park is Santa Elena Canyon, which is usually an overnight trip. I can't remember how many miles it is from the put-in to the takeout, but it's an overnight trip. And then there's, and this goes through a pretty narrow canyon. It's really pretty grand, actually, and it's a beautiful area.
And it's got big rocks down there in the river channel at one point.
Yes, right. There's a rapid called the Rock Slide, which
okay.
Is like Yeah, they kind of clog up the channel and you have to pick your way through them.
Yeah.
When it's real high water, the water goes over them, but I only saw that once out of six and a half years of being there.
Wow.
Then there's a stretch of river that's pretty open. You can drive car. I mean, they smuggle sometimes across it, but it's just open without any kind of cliffs or canyons. It's basically the low desert that goes for the next, third of the 80 miles, maybe 60 miles of the park boundary. And then in the middle of the park boundary, or the middle of this stretch of river that's along the southern boundary, is Mariscal Canyon, which is also that's another canyon where the river goes through a canyon upland area. There's a rapid in there called the Tight Squeeze, which really isn't that much of anything. And that's usually run as another overnight trip. I think you could do it as a day trip if you were out there to start with. And then there's another section of open canyon that might be 40 miles. I can't remember. And then there's Boquillas Canyon at the downstream end of the park that you would start your trip across. Well, there's a little town of Boquillas across from it, and you start your trip there. So there were three separate canyons, or canyons separated by big open water, and we would just patrol the canyon section. We really didn't patrol that open water section because there was no recreational boating going on there.
Did anybody run the whole thing just for fun? Let's run the whole Rio Grande through the park. Flat water or canyons?
People probably did, but it was pretty unusual. It really wasn't. I did that section from Santa Elena Canyon to through Mariscal once in that open water section, and it's not too exciting. But, you know, it's not bad in the sense that you're on a river and you're floating down and you're seeing what's going on.
I think there'd be birds and maybe,
yeah,
I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's not done very often. So there's a fourth section of canyon that we were responsible for. It's outside of the park on the downstream end. It's referred to as the Lower Canyons of the Rio Grande, or Lower Canyons. And it is not in Big Bend, but it was designated a wild and scenic river, and it is administered by Big Bend.
Okay.
So we would require permits to go down it, and we patrolled it. And that's an 80-mile section of really a great river trip through some canyons, a little bit, not quite as sheer-walled as Santa Elena, but canyons and then more open and then canyons and narrows and a lot of different topography down there, not just kind of flat desert. And I think they claim maybe class three rapids. They're not really that bad.
Right.
So we patrolled that as well. And it's a great stretch of river.
Wow.
So one thing that happened was that when I went there, I was a rafter, but I was not a canoer. And the water levels fell, like I said, I think. So I did a patrol through the lower canyons that had enough water to take a raft. I did a patrol through San Elena with a raft. I can remember when the water was high enough that we went over all the rocks in the in the rock slide. But pretty soon the water dropped and canoes were the way to go. And most of my time, I don't remember past that first year that I ever got back in a raft. Because it just wasn't enough water.
Okay.
So I had to learn how to canoe. And and I did fine because the water is not that, especially with lower volumes, it wasn't that challenging.
Yeah.
Although in the lower canyons, there's some spots where somebody was snapping pictures, and there's a picture of me, so this is how I can remember it. And I got into some tippiness, and I just grabbed the gunwales of the canoe, which is not what you want to do. You want to be paddling.
Right.
So that was the skill level I was at. I was like, oh, no, I'm going to tip, grab the sides of the canoe, and
Oh,
try and stabilize yourself, but, you know, I got better with doing it time after time. So so we did our patrols in the canoes.
And were you using canoes because the concept of inflatable kayaks hadn't kind of come online yet?
I think so.
Okay.
I think that's a good piece of it. But I will also say that you can carry a lot more stuff in a canoe than, so we had solo canoes.
Okay.
And we would, you know, we could carry a lot more than you can in an IK. We put little coolers in there. We had toilet systems, you know, just, you had more volume that you could fill with stuff.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely carry more, hands down.
Yeah. So we used canoes, and I lived in the center of the park. Most of the park staff lives in the center where the visitor center is. It's called Panther Junction. And then to the, on the west end of the park, near the river, there was a ranger station, or a ranger that was stationed there, a couple of them, at Castellone. That's where Santa Elena Canyon kind of ends and it opens up. There was a little campground there and a couple of rangers staff that were assigned down there. On the east end, there's some staff that's assigned. But most of the staff, and then in a high country, a place called the Chizos, there's more staff assigned there. But Panther Junction, where I lived, was kind of the hub of everything. Both people coming into the park would hit there first, the visitor center, and then go off and to these other locations. And the maintenance came out of there. The headquarters, the superintendent was there. And the river crew based itself out of the shop area there. So we had about, let's see, Marcos worked there. There was, I don't think there was very many of us, as a matter of fact. There was a fellow named Steve McAllister, McAllister, who volunteered. He wasn't there when I first got there, but he started volunteering a year, maybe 2 years later.
Cool.
And then he stuck with us and just became one of the crew year-round. He lived in his little camper in parking spot, an RV spot type thing, and just worked with us. And it was, he was a real asset. He was our third person that we kind of, between the three of us, we held everything together.
So would he get a per diem, sort of a food?
Yeah.
Food.
Yep. He got a per diem of some, got a per diem, and I think he probably got his site for free. So I don't think he was spending much money, but he wasn't making any. Yeah, so he was a real asset to us. We also had some people who volunteered to run our shuttles for us. It was I remember a couple that would come a few years in a row for a good chunk of the fall, I guess, and run shuttles for us, because the shuttle for the lower canyons took a while to drive there and get people and come back.
When you were doing your patrol trips, I'm thinking about places like Santa Elena Canyon, did your radios work in there?
Not in the canyon, no. I don't think that they worked in the canyon. They didn't even work very well at the mouth of the canyon. I can remember that. So it was spotty.
Okay.
In the lower canyons as well. And I don't remember the particulars, but just in general, I have to think that it was kind of spotty. I don't even know that we got much in the lower canyons. We might have had that, like, hike out if we had a situation, but we mostly didn't have situations, so it didn't.
Okay.
I don't remember it being a big deal.
And how did the river permit system work?
You just would come in and get issued a permit. So there's no restrictions on the number of people that were to launch.
Okay, so no allocations, none of that stuff.
Right, no allocations. You had to have a fire pan and a toilet, or a way of carrying out, some sort of a toilet, human waste disposal.
Did you have to have prior experience, or just didn't even ask?
Nope.
Okay.
Yeah. Nope, didn't even ask.
Neat.
Right, real easy, pretty easy going. Thinking about the season for the river there was fall and spring, I'm pretty sure, as I remember, because it was really hot in summer.
Yeah.
And not too many people would come there to run the river in the summer. And in the winter, some people would come down in the winter, but the bulk of the people were either spring break, Easter break, spring, or in the fall, which was really a great time of year.
Would it freeze in the winter?
Yeah. I mean, it would occasionally get below freezing as far as the air temperature would go.
Right.
In the winter, the river never froze, of course.
Okay.
But the air could get below freezing overnight. It didn't always. I don't know. I would say maybe 1 out of 10 nights, maybe, or, you know, maybe there was 2 consecutive nights that it got cold, and then it didn't get cold again for another 20 nights.
And it's got to be, what, 1,000 foot above sea level or so, less?
Yeah, I'm going to, probably.
The river?
I can't remember.
Okay. Because it's just going down to the to the Gulf of Mexico, so it's it can't be that high.
Right.
So it should be warm enough in the winter. But again, it depends. Yeah. It sounds like it depends on what the Mexicans are doing with their dam and their water release.
Right, right. And so I think there's almost always a minimal trickle that just comes from, I don't know where, the ground. Maybe there's leakages out of the dam. Maybe there's subterranean stuff coming out of, El Paso down the channel there. But it seems like, well, actually I was talking to people recently because I'm going to try and do a Lower Canyons trip in February.
Oh, cool.
So I have been recently in touch with people there to say, you know, is there going to be enough water for, and we're going to take IKs.
Okay.
And so I was asking them, saying, I can't remember that we ever had trouble with water levels in terms of us taking canoes, but what's it like now? And the guy that now has the job I had said, no, you know, we always just seem to be fine to get canoes down. Every now and then, maybe you have to drag the upper part above San Elena Canyon. But he said it just seems like...
Cool.
And it sounds like there's only 150 CFS sometimes.
Okay.
But it just kind of channels, I guess, and
right. You
can get the canoes down. So I had no memory of not doing trips because the water was too low. But then I thought maybe it's worse, or maybe I misremembered, and I had contacted the current district ranger, and he said, no, it seems like we just, you know, if we want to go, we're going to go.
Okay.
I remember a real cold patrol once, though, just back to the temperatures. I can remember being in the lower canyons, and it might have been October, November, probably November, maybe December. We didn't do a lot of patrols in December or January because it just wasn't a volume of people down there, but I can remember being down when it was like 27 degrees when we woke up in the morning, and it felt cold for when you're adapted to, your body's adapted to the temperatures in Big Bend, which were generally warmer.
Yeah, and if there's a little humidity,
it's
double cold.
Yeah. I really enjoyed working in Big Bend. I haven't been watching time. Do you want to? Are we getting short
of
time?
No, this would be a good place. We've been going about an hour and 10, hour and 8 minutes.
Okay.
I would like to know more about Big Bend and sort of the issues that you dealt with there. So if this is a good place to put a comma, let's do that.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Great. Okay, well, this will then conclude part 6, oral history interview with Pat Gredigan. Today is Thursday, November 26th, 2020. Pat, thank you so very much.
Yeah, you're very welcome.